This morning, we return to our study of the book of Daniel, having had a week where Myron was preaching. We're back now to our study of Daniel, and our text today is found in chapter 11. So we come to the chapter today. Let us remember a few things that we went over in our introductory sermon to this section. Chapters 10, 11, and 12 are a unit here in the book of Daniel, and they constitute the final segment of the book of Daniel. Here we have the final vision, or we could call it the prophetic revelation that God gave to Daniel, the final revelation that he is passing on as an instrument of God's truth. And the structure of this section is quite easy to outline. In chapter 10, we have the introduction to the prophecy. Chapter 11, the prophecy itself, and chapter 12, the conclusion to the prophecy. But remembering what this prophecy is about, as we saw in chapter 10, might be helpful. In verse 1 of chapter 10, it says, "In the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, a thing was revealed unto Daniel, whose name was called Belteshazzar, and the thing was true. But the time appointed was long, and he understood the thing, and he had understanding of the vision." Daniel is now near the end of his life. We are in the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, and we believe that Daniel is no longer someone who is in the position of authority in the government of Persia. He is with, no doubt, his Jewish brethren, the captives, because he sees this vision with them. They don't see the vision, but they are with him when he does see the vision. So he's come near the end of his life, and he's given here a vision where we're told that the thing is true. What we're looking at here is God's truth. It is something sure. The time appointed was long. That is, the things that are spoken about in this prophecy cover a long period of time. And we are told that Daniel had understanding in the vision. When it says here the time appointed was long, the idea that's being brought here by the passage can be expressed in this fashion, that it's talking about something in terms of years. However, and I'm sort of contradicting myself here, please forgive me, let me go back onto that. You understood the thing was long is not a reference to time, but it's a reference to warfare. The word here that refers to the time appointed was long actually refers to a great host. Time appointed is a translation where the translators believe he's talking about a host of years. But it's better understood, it's more normally understood as an army or conflict and warfare. And, of course, the miseries that are brought about by war. And the vision that we're looking at is about conflict and about warfare that shall rage among the Gentiles who rule Palestine. And also a final war between the Gentiles and the Jews, and I think that's the subject of chapter 12. But furthermore, conflict in the term of persecution. Armies will be involved in this. They will be involved in warfare, and they will be involved in persecution. What this prophecy is telling Daniel's people who will live during this period is that it will be a difficult time in Palestine and Jerusalem. There will be conflict troubling them. And so that the hearts of the godly do not faint. They are fortified by these predictions ahead of time so that they might wait with patience the coming of the Messiah. But in that wait, they will undergo many trials and many sufferings. And what lies ahead for them is war and persecution. Not necessarily them fighting the wars, but they will live in a region of the world that is troubled by war. Furthermore, in verse 14, it says, "Now I come to make thee understand what shall befall thy people in the latter days, for yet the vision is for many days." Here's the idea, the vision being for many days, that this is something that is in the future, many days yet to come, and this will cover a period of many days. But here he says it's in the latter days. And we've talked about this here in Daniel, especially in chapter 2, verse 28, that the term latter days was a term used in the Old Testament, but it's called a technical term, to identify a period of time in history, and that period being the time of the Messiah. From the Old Testament view, in the end of days is when the Messiah comes. That's their perspective. We are living right now, according to the New Testament apostles, in these latter days, which began in the ministry of Christ and particularly was identified with His death, resurrection, and the sending of the Spirit in the day of Pentecost. So Peter could say, concerning a Joel prophecy that said, in the last days I will pour out My Spirit. Peter said, this is that. We are in the last days. But this tells us in terms of this prophecy that the vision is going to deal with matters relating to the Messiah and the Messianic coming. This does not necessarily mean that everything in the prophecy is dealing with that period of time. Even as we saw very clearly in chapter 2, it was not dealing with that time exclusively because we had the four metals of the image and we started with Babylon. But where did it end? With the rock, the stone cut out without hands that strikes the image and the Messianic kingdom comes. And so it begins at Babylon, stretches unto the Messiah. And this is what this prophecy, I believe, is about, and I take that from this statement. It's going to take us up through the period of time of captivity unto the end of days, that is, the days when the Messiah appears. From this standpoint, since we saw this prophecy was given in the third year of Cyrus, it doesn't go from the beginning of the captivity from Babylon, but at the end of the captivity, when under Cyrus, they were allowed to return to Jerusalem and to Palestine. And so this prophecy goes from Persia to Christ, the time period. This fits the general pattern that we've seen in the book of Daniel. This is the purpose of Daniel. Daniel, the history of Daniel, the prophecies of Daniel are fulfilled. We do not mean by this that the impact of the coming of the Messiah and the growing of the kingdom, for example, in chapter 2, has now already taken place. No, it is now in process. But these prophecies of the events leading up to the Messiah are fulfilled. These are not future events. We live in the future event, as it were, of Daniel, the Messianic era, wherein, as we saw in chapter 7, the Messiah will come to govern all nations and all peoples. We're living in that part of the fulfillment yet. That has not been completed. It is in the process of fulfillment. But these other details have come to pass. And we've talked about that quite extensively in our study here of the book of Daniel. Now chapter 11, as we come to chapter 11, we come to a unique chapter in the Bible. Really, there's nothing quite like it. Because it contains a fairly detailed prophecy of wars and conflicts future to the time of the writing. The wars and conflicts of Scripture are, when there's any detail given, are reports of what has already happened, such as in the book of Samuel and Kings and so forth. But the wars and battles and conflicts of chapter 11, from Daniel's perspective, are about things that are yet hundreds of years in the future. Earlier in the book of Daniel, we saw some prophecies about wars and conflicts, but they were covered with just a couple of statements, general statements, such as the beast in chapter 7, the Roman beast that would grind all others underneath its feet, telling there would be conflict and war and they would win. This here gives us a detailed account of conflicts and battles that lie in the future from Daniel's standpoint, from which his people will have to come through if they are to faithfully continue to hold on to their trust in God and their waiting for the Messiah. Chapter 11 is one of those miracles of biblical prophecy. Historians can come to this chapter and they can go and they can look at this prophecy and think, oh yeah, this is what happened, yeah, that's, this is that, this is that, and look at history that's already been fulfilled and has been written up and see how Daniel predicted it 100 years ahead of time. It is so precise and so to the point that liberals who deny the inspiration of Scripture say this could not have been written by a man named Daniel in the era of Persia. It was written by somebody who had lived through them and he was just reporting as an historian. But we know these are the words of Daniel. Our Lord Jesus Christ Himself signified Daniel as the author of these books when He spoke of Daniel and the fulfillment of his prophecy. Now, as we come to this chapter also, there is general agreement among interpreters up until verse 36 as to what is the subject of the chapter. But when we come to verse 36, there are differences, and we will note that as we go along in time and according to the place that we find it. So let's now begin to look at this chapter. It begins with a prophecy concerning Persia, very brief. Then a prophecy concerning Greece, again, very brief. But taking our history from the time when Daniel's writing, what's going to happen in Persia yet, then what's going to happen when the country of Greece arises. And then in verses 5 through 20, we have a lengthy section that will deal specifically with these wars that I was speaking about. Let us read. I, in the first year of Darius the Mede, even I stood to confirm and strengthen him. And now I will show thee the truth. Behold, there shall stand up yet three kings in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than they all, and by his strength, through his riches, he will stir up all against the realm of Grecia. And a mighty king shall stand up, and shall rule with great dominion, and do according to his will. And when he shall stand up, his kingdom shall be broken, and shall be divided toward the four winds of heaven. And not to his posterity, nor according to his dominion which he ruled, for his kingdom shall be plucked up, even for others beside those. Verses 1 and 2 gives us the prophecy concerning Persia. But what's interesting in verse 1 is we talk about the role of the angelic realm in kingdoms. Here this angel who is speaking to Daniel tells him about his role in strengthening Darius the Mede. And that he was God's instrument in confirming this man in his office and then strengthening the man to do the work that God had called this heathen man to do for him. Because even the wrath of men praise him. God uses even the sins of men and sinful men who do not know Him to accomplish His purposes. And this angel, probably Gabriel, again going back to our last study where we talked about that, was God's agent to confirm Darius in his office and then strengthen him to govern. Some of this may refer to the fact, too, that Darius chose who to be his right-hand man and the next in power in the kingdom? Daniel. Maybe we can't be in any way sure of this, but Darius was confirmed and strengthened to elevate Daniel and to be kind toward the Jews. However, you know, some men did trick Darius using his pride and arrogance and get him to sign that decree that he, as soon as he understood the implications of, was deeply grieved and tried to save Daniel about not praying to any god but him. But Darius was good to the Jews, and he was good to Daniel. And perhaps, too, this Gabriel was the very angel that was sent to deliver Daniel from the lions. Again, just some suppositions here. Verse 2 tells us about four kings who are yet to come after Cyrus, and the final one will be a king of great riches. And this is no doubt this final king, Xerxes, or the Ahasuerus of the book of Esther, who amassed great wealth and spent a huge amount to build up an army and a fleet of ships to attack and subdue Macedonia or Greece. But he failed. And his failure began the downfall and the downfall of Persia and the beginning of the rise of Greece. And then in verses 3 and 4, we hear about the rise of Greece, where it comes to the point where they cast off the Persian yoke and become the dominant power. Verse 3 speaks of Alexander the Great, this mighty king that stands up and rules with great dominion, doing according to his will. Truly, this is an excellent discussion or description of Alexander. We talked about him also in chapter 8, verses 5 through 8, if you'll remember, in the prophecy there concerning him. And verse 4 talks about the division of Alexander's vast empire after his untimely death at the age of 33. What happened at that time, as this passage says, it did not go into any of his heirs, any of his physical descendants. No, none of his sons received this kingdom. I'm not real sure of the history of his sons, but I'm aware that some of them had been assassinated. Whether they all were dead at this time, I don't know. But instead of going to, as it says here, to his posterity, it was divided among his generals. And that period of time took a while to sort out. But finally a fourfold division came about. And for our purposes, in this passage, the area of Syria, and that is the east, which would have included the realm of Judea, was given to Seleucus, and the area of Egypt to Ptolemy. And what began under these men were two dynasties, the Seleucid dynasty and the Ptolemaic dynasty. And now coming to verses 5 through 20, we have the prophecy of wars between these two divisions of Alexander's kingdom. Beginning in verse 5, where the focus is now on these two portions of the kingdom, Alexander's kingdom. But why would we focus on these and not the others? It's very obvious and elementary, because their conflicts and actions had a direct bearing on the Jews in Judea. Syria is to the north, Egypt is to the south, and who is in between? Palestine, Judea, Jerusalem. And as these contending dynasties and armies would go, they would cross to and fro from the land of Palestine, sometimes fighting in that very region. And so, for the sake of the people of God, their history is very important. And that's what's recorded here. So that the godly in Israel will understand that when they see these things happening, they were already predicted. God is in control of these things. This is the message of Daniel. God is sovereign over who is ruling, who is reigning. He puts men up, He takes them down, He raises up kingdoms, He overthrows them, He uses them for His purpose. And if you were living during these hundreds of years of conflict, you might grow weary in spirit and heart. And from father to son to grandson, you're just wondering, when is the end? But you go get comfort as you go to Daniel and see all of this was predicted. It's all in the hands of God, and it will eventuate in chapter 12 and the Messiah. And so this is the purpose why this is in here. It's very important for those people. And we're going to see there's some good applications for us to draw out here as well. The period of time that is covered in these verses 5 through 20, begins with about 323 B.C. down to 175 B.C., just to give you a little historical note there. And primarily, verses 6 through 20, which is only one verse into it, is from 250 B.C. to 175 B.C. And what I'm going to do here on these verses, I'm going to read these with little comment. I didn't see any purpose to necessarily try to identify what all these historical acts were and so forth. Those who desire that can find it in any standard commentary on Daniel. And if someone doesn't have one and would like to borrow one from me so they can read about some of these things, I would be glad to do so. So let's just look at these prophecies here. And in the end of years they shall join themselves together, for the king's daughter of the south shall come to the king of the north to make an agreement. But she shall not retain the power of the arm, neither shall he stand nor his arm, but she shall be given up, and they that brought her, and he that begot her, and he that strengthened her in these times. But out of a branch of her roots shall stand up one in his estate, which shall come with an army, and shall enter into the fortress of the king of the north, and shall deal against them, and shall prevail. Now notice here, there's two statements, the king of the north and the king of the south throughout this section. Of course, the king of the north would be the Seleucid dynasty, the descendants from Seleucus, and then those in the south would be that of the Ptolemaic dynasty, which were headquartered in the area of Egypt, Alexandria, and so forth. So that's what we're talking about, the battles here between the king of the north and the king of the south. Verse 8, and shall also carry captives into Egypt their gods with their princes and with their precious vessels of silver and gold, and he shall continue more years than the king of the north. So the king of the south shall come into his kingdom and shall return into his own land. So back and forth, this conflict in the area of Palestine. But his sons shall be stirred up and shall assemble a multitude of great forces, and one shall certainly come and overflow and pass through. Then shall he return and be stirred up even to his fortress. And the king of the south shall be moved with choler, anger, and so forth, and shall come forth and fight with him, even with the king of the north, and he shall set forth a great multitude, but the multitude shall be given into his hand. And when he hath taken away the multitude, his heart shall be lifted up, and he shall cast down many, 10,000s, but he shall not be strengthened by it. For the king of the north shall return, and shall set forth a multitude greater than the former, and shall certainly come after certain years with a great army and with much riches. And in those times there shall many stand up against the king of the south. Also the robbers of thy people shall exalt themselves to establish the vision, but they shall fall. Now here we want to pause for a minute. Here's an interesting statement. This is a specific reference to actions by certain of the people of Judea, of the Jews. Here it refers to those in Israel who made a league with the Seleucids, with Antiochus, against the Ptolemies in Egypt. Here they are called the robbers of thy people. Literally those who make a breach. And robbers are usually those who make a breach and invade a place. But the idea here is those who break God's law. These are law-breaking Jews. They are lawless men. And they are making agreements, they are making league with one of the sides, and they say, to fulfill the vision. Indicating that the thing they're going to be the means of fulfilling the vision here of this passage. They will be aware of it. And they will try to make it come to pass by their own intrigues and alliances. But notice these are lawless men who are doing this. It seems to me this is counseling the Jews in this passage. Stay aloof from the conflicts of the Seleucids and the Ptolemies during these years. Do not get involved with them. Do not make league or alliance with one or the other. Their wars will go back and forth, and one day you make a league with one and you receive benefit from that, but surely the others are going to come and sweep through the land and you will be punished for that. Stay aloof from their wars. Don't involve yourself in them. And I couldn't help but think of that counsel, though this is not an application per se, but just this is, I'm now leaving the text. And I'm just very concerned about the direction our nation is going. And I think of the counsel of George Washington when he said, stay aloof from the conflicts of the old world. Stay aloof. We do live in a new world. We do live in a different situation. However, it seems as though when you throw yourself into these conflicts that are not yours, there's a price to pay. You need to stay aloof from them, was Washington's counsel. And it made me think of that in our days in which we live. And it seems to me this is Daniel's counsel, or really God's counsel, through the angel that Daniel recorded. You know, the lawless men were the ones who sought to make things happen, not trusting the sovereignty of God in this particular situation, going against, really, the teaching of Daniel. But they shall fall, says in verse 14. They shall fail, and they shall bring hardships upon themselves and their fellow Jews for their doing. Where are we at? Okay, verse 15, excuse me. So the king of the south shall come and cast up a mount and take the most fenced cities, and the arms of the south shall not withstand, neither his chosen people, neither shall there be any strength to withstand. But he that cometh against him shall do according to his own will, and none shall stand before him, and he shall stand in the glorious land, which by his hand shall be consumed. That's the glorious land is Palestine, Judea. Again, here these are predictions. This is going to be a tough time. The land is going to be consumed by this man. Don't lose heart. This is all in God's plan. Verse 17, he shall also set his face to enter with strength of his whole kingdom and upright ones with him. Thus shall he do when he shall give him the daughter of women, corrupting her, but these are the intrigues, the intermarriages and so forth. But she shall not stand on his side, neither be for him. And this shall he turn his face unto the isles and shall take many, but a prince for his own behalf shall cause the reproach offered by him to cease. Without his own reproach, he shall cause it to return upon him. Then he shall turn his face toward the fort of his own land, but he shall stumble and fall and not be found. Then he shall stand up in his estate, a raiser of taxes in the glory of the kingdom. Within a few days he shall be destroyed, neither in anger nor in battle. Now we come to the section where I would like to look at more closely. Again, these others are important in that they would have been the comfort to the people of God, understanding that with all of this war and armies, and just to stand fast, not lose heart, stay out of the conflicts, do not ally yourself with one side or the other. And the fulfillment of these can be traced in any standard commentary on that. And that wasn't my purpose to do that today. However, we want to look more closely now at verse 21 to 35, where we now turn to the biggest, or the I should say the focus of this passage. And that is the wars and persecutions of Antiochus Epiphanes. Notice what it says, and in his state shall stand up a vile person. And beginning with this verse, down to verse 35, we're talking about this vile person. He brought great hardship upon Israel. And in his estate shall stand up a vile person to whom they shall not give the honor of the kingdom, but he shall come in peaceably and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. This vile person who came to power from among the kings of the north is none other than the notorious Antiochus Epiphanes, who ruled from 175 to 164 B.C. He was an evil man and a great persecutor of the Jews. We have encountered him already in our studies of Daniel, in the prophecy of Daniel chapter 8, verses 9 to 12, and verses 23 to 25. You may recall we looked at detail at this man in that section. This is the same individual that is spoken of in Daniel 8, 9 to 12, and then the interpretation of that man in verses 23 to 25 of the same chapter 8. What we have here is further information now being revealed concerning his rule, because it was so significant and eventful for Israel. And as far as I know, just about every interpreter that I've seen agrees that this is a prophecy of Antiochus Epiphanes, of events in the past. Verses 21 and 24 talk about his rise to power and how he came about. I want to read you a quote by a man named Stewart who gives us a good summation of this man. He says, Antiochus was one of the most extraordinary characters exhibited on the pages of history. He was both avaricious and prodigal, excessive in his indulgences and prone to violent passions, a compound of the various folly and weakness in some respects, and of great cunning and dexterity in some others, especially in regard to flattery. At one period of his reign, there was a prospect of him becoming quite powerful. But reverses came upon him, and he died at last, nearly as his father had done before him, and on like occasion. Indeed, his extravagances and follies and cruelties were so great that his contemporaries gave him the nickname Epiphanes, meaning madman, instead of the title which he assumed for himself, Epiphanes, meaning illustrious. He named himself Antiochus the Illustrious. His contemporaries called him Antiochus the Madman. This is the individual that we're talking about here who's going to do great harm to Israel. We're told that he takes this kingdom. The honor didn't belong to him. He was not next in succession for the kingship among the Seleucids, but he gained it in a peaceable way, not through warfare. He did it through flattery. He was a very cunning man, and we saw this in chapter 8 as well, who knew how to use intrigue and flattery and so forth to get what he wanted. In verse 22, it says, and with arms of a flood shall they be overthrown from before him and shall be broken, yea, also the prince of the covenant. This refers to Antiochus and the forces of Egypt under the Ptolemies. Through deceit, he was able to win them over, as verse 23 says. And after the league was made with him, he shall work deceitfully. There was some kind of a peace agreement made between the Egyptians and Syrians, between these two dynasties. But then after he made this league, he made this treaty, this covenant, he worked deceitfully and he overthrew them. And that's what's being described here in verses 23 and 24. And after the league made with him, he shall work deceitfully, for he shall come up and shall become strong with a small people, and he shall enter peaceably even upon the fattest places of the province, and shall do that which his fathers have not done, that is in Egypt, nor his father's fathers. He shall scatter among them the prey and spoil and riches, and yea, he shall forecast his devices against the strongholds even for a time. Verse 25 continues, and he shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south with a great army. And the king of the south shall be stirred up to battle with a very great and mighty army, but he shall not stand, for they shall forecast devices against him. And so he is victorious here in his first Egyptian campaign, which is being described in these verses. Yea, they shall feed the portion of his meat, shall destroy him, and his army shall overflow, and many shall fall down slain. And both these kings' hearts shall be to do mischief, and they shall speak lies at one table, but it shall not prosper, for yet the end shall be at the time appointed. Then shall he return in his land with great riches, and his heart shall be against the holy covenant, and he shall do exploits and return to his own land. This is an explanation of his first Egyptian campaign. And what happened, we're told here, though, in verse 28, when he returns from his victories in Egypt, he turns his heart against the Holy Covenant, against the Jews. And if you remember when we studied this in chapter 8, we looked in the book of 1 Maccabees and we saw of the atrocities that he committed against the Jewish people. Murdering and killing many, levying taxes, plundering the temple of its riches and vessels and implements. So in other words, on his victorious return back to his own fortress, his own place in Syria, he plundered the temple, persecuted the people of God. Verse 29 gives to us his next Egyptian campaign. It says, at the appointed time he shall return and come toward the south. He will then leave his area in the north, come through Palestine, and he shall attack Egypt again for the sake of booty and plunder and conquest and glory. But something's going to happen to him in verse 30. It says, the ships of Chittim shall come against him. Now, in the Old Testament, Chittim was referred initially to the island of Cyprus, which, as you know, was east, or west, I should say, of Palestine in the Mediterranean. And it came that the idea of those from Chittim, or anybody that came from the west. This is a reference, interestingly, to the Romans. For the Romans are now coming on the scene, for they came from Chittim. They came from the west in the Mediterranean Sea, because Rome is now coming to power and starting to exercise itself. And what happened is, the Romans, who at this point in history had already subdued those portions of Alexander's kingdom in Macedonia, were now seeking to pursue Antiochus in the realm of Syria. And they began their campaign against him by preventing his success in this Egyptian campaign. And they sent their ships to stop him. This was about 167 B.C. And look what it says here. They come against him, and then they stop him. Therefore shall be grieved and return and have indignation against the Holy Covenant. So shall he do. He shall even return and have intelligence with them that forsake the Holy Covenant. Antiochus is enraged. He is grieved by Roman interference in his plans. And he fails in this expedition. And on his way back to Syria, he vents his anger and malice upon who? Israel. Upon Israel. Upon the Holy Covenant. That is, the covenant that God made with Israel, that bound Israel in loyalty to himself and obedience to his law. Here we're told that he will have intelligence with them that forsake God's covenant. And we know from the histories of the Maccabees that there were many apostates in Israel who betrayed Israel and their people into Antiochus and helped further his evil designs against Israel. Verse 31, it says, An arm shall stand on his part, and they shall pollute the sanctuary of strength, and shall take away the daily sacrifice, and they shall place the abomination that maketh desolation. Again, these things we discussed in chapter 8, and so I'm not going to go into them in detail again. But what we do see here, and we do understand from the histories, is Antiochus' goal was to obliterate every trace of the Jewish faith and the covenantal life that God had commanded his people to live. His goal was the complete Hellenization. That means turning into Greek culture. To Hellenize was to make someone into a Greek, a pagan Greek, rather than a holy son or daughter of the covenant. And his goal was to make the Jews good Greeks and to overthrow their way of life and their obedience to the law of God. And the epitome of this is described in this verse where he sent his soldiers to surround the temple and to keep it from the worship of God, to tear down the altars there and to erect an altar, this abomination of desolation, this abomination that desolates the temple, that was a heathen altar to the god Jupiter that he set up there in the very place of the temple. This is described in 1 Maccabees 41 through 61, what he does here. And so it was a period now of intense persecution. And many of the Jews yielded to the pressure. Antiochus had altars to heathen gods set up in all the major areas of Israel and commanded the leaders and the people to come and offer sacrifices on these, to abandon their ways of life, to forget circumcision, and to abandon the worship of God and to follow the ways of the Greeks. And those who did were rewarded very handsomely by the Seleucids, by Antiochus. And therefore there was great pressure to forsake and great benefits to those who did. But let us look now at the responses to this. And there's really only two responses to this kind of pressure. And here's where we must pay attention, because the same pressures in different ways, in different sense in our life, is being applied to us. The enemies of God are still the same as Antiochus. They relentlessly want to overturn the Holy Covenant. And they want to force the people of God to abandon their obedience to Him and become like them in their secular pagan mindset and culture. And it depends where you stand in history and where you are culturally as to how great the pressure is and how much the price is. But notice there's really only two possible responses to those who seek to get us to forsake the Holy Covenant. Here's what it says. And such as do wickedly against the covenant shall he corrupt by flattery. There will be those among the Jews, Daniel's predicting, and this is exactly what happened, many of them did wickedly against God's covenant. They were covenant breakers. They were unfaithful to the law of God. They were corrupted by flattery, promises of peace and honor and riches and so forth. And they did wickedly against God's covenant as they listened to the flatteries of Antiochus and his henchmen. That's one response. And the other response is this, verse 32, but the people that do know their God shall be strong and do exploits. And they that understand among the people shall instruct many, yet they shall fall by the sword and by flame, by captivity and by spoil many days. And when they shall fall, they shall be hope of little help. But many shall cleave to them with flatteries. And some of them understanding shall fall to try them and to purge and to make them white even for the time of the end, because it is yet for a time appointed. There's no neutrality when it comes to persecution. There's only two courses open to us. We remain faithful to God's covenant, or we fall by the pressure and the flatteries. And here we see those who believe in God among Israel in this day, as it's talking about, remain true to God's covenant. These are the people who know their God. The true believers. They refuse. One of the great stories in the Maccabees is of a man named Matthias, who was the leader of a Jewish community. And when the agents of Antiochus came to their town and they called upon the leading men to gather there and to sacrifice on this altar, and Matthias was called upon to lead the way, and he refused to do it. And he spoke courageously against it. But then some other man, another leader in the Jewish community there, came forward and went to begin to offer his sacrifice. And we're told in the Maccabees that Matthias was filled with zeal for God's covenant. And he slew the man, the Jewish man. And he slew the officers of the king and proclaimed all those who would stand for God's covenant to rally to him. And this was the beginning of the resistance of the Maccabees. For his son, Judas Maccabeus, the word Maccabeus means the hammer. That was the name they gave to him. Rallied, and this began the resistance by those who were true to the Lord in that period of time. That was just the story of one man. Many others died. They were burnt to death. They were slaughtered by the sword because they would not worship the gods of the Greeks. They would not forsake their covenant with God. These godly men, we're told here, were strong. They were strong in faith and refused all the false honors and gifts, and they resisted all pressures against them in this situation, which was intense. But they stood true to God's covenant. They did exploits. They did righteousness. They rose up in defense of God's covenant. It's interesting to note here that these men who are called to be those who know their God, who are strong and do exploits, use armed resistance in this situation against the wicked. And it says they will instruct many. These are men who know the truth, and they were greatly concerned to teach it to their Jewish friends. Look at the suffering they will undergo. Death by the sword and fire, verse 33. Captivity, which usually back then meant slavery. Captain sent off to the mine somewhere, or off to some Greek galley or something to slave away. Spoiled of their goods. In other words, many will lose everything in this time of persecution. Their lives, some their freedom, others their goods, and some perhaps all three. Spoiled of goods, go into slavery, and then die in that situation. Verse 34 seems to refer to the deliverance, the measure of deliverance that came about by Judas and the Maccabeus, who did lead Israel in war against the Syrians, and they were successful. And they threw off the Syrian yoke and gained a measure of independence. And this lasted for a while, but only for a time. For from the Maccabean line came the Herods and the Herodian dynasty that then oppressed them, as then also Rome finally took control over Palestine. So it was just a short time of deliverance from heathen domination. And the last part of the verse there, verse 34, probably speaks in the time of this throwing off of the Syrian persecution and dominion, they will have men who come with them who are not sincere. And that always happens in this type of thing. Verse 35 is interesting because it speaks of the winnowing effect of persecution. The winnowing effect of persecution. What does it say? This will be a time of trying them, purging them, and purifying them. Who? The true faithful among Israel. God is sending this persecution. It's in His hands. Because it says here it's for a time, for the time of the end. It's for the time appointed. In other words, this is talking about a fixed period of time in the providence of God when He will allow His people to undergo these severe trials and testings and persecutions. And I think verses 32 to 35 give us a unique statement on persecution. And I commend them to you for in the future for your reflection and study and prayer, because, well, let's just talk about it here. There's six things briefly. This passage tells us when the time of persecution comes. And when is that? Look at the context. Look at the history. It's when the wicked are in authority. The people of God are persecuted when the authorities that be, the civil authorities or religious authorities, are evil men. Here are the religious authorities, and these are clear pagans. These are the Seleucids. These are the Greeks. But persecution comes when the wicked are in authority and when God's law is being forsaken. When the law of God is set aside. This is when persecution happens. It doesn't happen when the godly are in authority. It always happens when the wicked are in authority. And I think we ought to take note of that as we look at the direction this nation is heading in. Truly, God's law is being forsaken on every side. More and more, the wicked are coming into positions of authority in every realm of our society, from education to politics to business and so forth. What happens in that kind of a time? Persecution. What is the response to persecution? We must prepare ourselves because we never know what God's purposes are and understand that when persecution comes, there is no neutrality. You either faint under it and apostatize, or God, by His grace, because you truly know your God, you become strong and you stand faithful. That's the only response as possible. That can, by the way, be taken into much smaller increments. Even in our own lives, some of us are members of families that particularly are maybe not Christian, or they do not like our commitment to just follow God's law as a family. And we undergo measures of persecution. Will we be pressured to fall away from our sincere belief in the standards of God's covenant, or will we fall because of the pressure? There's no neutrality in persecution. You cannot appease the enemies of God's covenant. And every appeasement will be a surrender of principle. Number three, the duty in persecution is set forth in this passage. There's three things that the people of God need to plead with God for the strength to do. Three things: be strong in faith, to do righteousness, and to teach others. Number four, the suffering in persecution. It's all here. Starting with the loss of goods, fines, that type of thing, seizure of property or whatever, imprisonment, and finally even death. This is what persecution brings to the people of God: the loss of their goods, imprisonment, and in some places and times, and often death. And of course, church history is clear on that. That's the suffering in persecution. What's the effect of persecution? It tests the hearts of those who claim to be God's people. It separates between the wheat and the chaff, and thereby purifies the church and believers. And we see that in that verse. What happens? God sends persecution to try to purge and to make white, there in verse 35. Finally, the period of persecution is always under the control of God. This is a great comfort. Whenever the church is in persecution, it's only for a time, for God's purpose. History has shown this, and it will show it in the future. The persecutions of the early church, when we studied about the Caesars, how they persecuted the church, there were only periods of time. It was not constant in the Roman Empire. Caesars would rise. Christians would lose their goods. They'd be imprisoned and many put to death. The church, the hearts of the men who claimed to be Christians were tested. The separation between the wheat and the chaff took place, and the church was purified by it. But those periods came to an end. And persecution, the period thereof, is always determined by God, and it's only for a time. For the victory is ours through Christ who loves us, though He does bring persecution to His people. So we see the time of persecution, the response to persecution, the duty of God's people in persecution, suffering that takes place in a period of persecution, the effect of persecution on the church, and the period of persecution. And so again, I commend these verses to you. A unique statement on persecution that the people of God, when they're faced by it, can receive great comfort and strength. When we come to verse 36, we'll wrap things up here. When we come to verse 36, we have a shift from Antiochus. There is a difference here now in the text. We are moving on to a new segment. And here we come to a place, as I said, there was pretty much unanimous opinion. When we get to verse 36, there is much difference of opinion as to who is being spoken about, or the subject here of this portion of the Word of God. The principal views are that this is a continuation of Antiochus Epiphanes and there is no change. Another main view is that this is the Antichrist who shall arise in the end. A third view is that this is the Pope. This was a very popular view in the time of the Reformation. And another view is that this is a prophecy of Rome, the Roman Empire, particularly of the Caesars. And I'll just tell you, I believe that it's of Rome. I think that this passage we're talking now in verse 36 through 45 about Rome. And I cannot be dogmatic about this. No one can be dogmatic. This is a difficult passage. But let me show you, explain to you why. I believe there is a shift in the text here. We're not talking about Antiochus anymore, in other words. Throughout this passage, when we've spoken about the kings, it's been either the king of the north or the king of the south. Here it's just simply spoken about of the king, not about an identification of the warring parties of the Ptolemies or the Seleucids. Furthermore, verses 36 to 45 do not fit the history of Antiochus. And that's why many do not see him in this passage and move it to be either the future Antichrist, the Pope, something like that, or the Roman Empire. And so there is a shift in the text here. We're moving from Antiochus's atrocities against Israel, and now we're talking about the king. The king. Furthermore, the view that this is Rome, I think, agrees with the pattern of Daniel, which is tracing the history of the kingdoms of the Near East from captivity to Christ. Even as I said in the beginning of this sermon, the phrase, the last days, are given to us in chapter 10, verse 14, as being within the time frame of this prophecy. Then, in other words, taking us from Persia to Christ. We've seen the Persians, we've seen the Greeks, we've seen the Ptolemies, and now we see the Romans, and in chapter 12 we see Christ. Number three, I think that Rome, particularly as we think of Rome as manifested through the career of the Caesars, agrees with the description in verses 36 and 39. And it goes, and if we compare this with Daniel 7, 23 to 25, where we look at the little horn, which we identified there as being the Roman Caesars and their blasphemy and all that, it almost fits the wording here precisely as to what was said there. Number four, the actual history of Rome in this area of the world agrees with what's in the text here. As we'll look at that here briefly. The history here agrees with what Rome's involvement in that area of the world. And finally, having Rome here fits the need of the godly to be instructed in the times between Antiochus and the coming of Christ, which were still 160 years away. This gives them, in other words, comfort and teaching that they will know what is going to be happening in their midst from the time of Persia to Christ. That is, well, here's what comes after Antiochus. Let's briefly then look at these verses. If somebody has a challenge to that view during an interaction, that's fine. So we do not want to be dogmatic, but I do believe that the weight of factors points to Rome. And the king shall do according to his will and shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every god. This is the Roman Caesars. The Roman Caesars were very, really, in their own purpose, like, pretty contemptuous of the gods. They knew that religion was important. They, as far as in the cultures and their own and in the nations they conquered, and they appeared to give honor to the gods. But if you read about them, for example, in Suetonius' history of the Caesars, they pretty much held the gods in contempt, particularly the true God of Israel. It says that they shall magnify themselves above every god. They're greater than the gods in their own minds. And shall speak marvelous things against the God of gods. They're very blasphemous against the true God. And shall prosper till the indignation be accomplished, for that is determined shall be done. What indignation? God's indignation against them! They'll prosper only, though, again, this is the comfort to the godly, for a time. God's anger will remove them. It's appointed. So the wicked men who are extremely proud and who blaspheme the God of heaven often come to authority. Let us remember their time is appointed and it shall come to an end in God's good time and for His purpose. Neither shall he regard the God of his fathers nor the desire of women. This desire of women here is not talking about anything having to do with marriage or marital relations, but it's talking here, I believe, the desire of women being a name for the goddesses. In other words, the gods and the goddesses will be not regarded by them. They won't regard their ancestral gods, nor will they regard the desire of the women, the heathen deities that were female, the goddesses. Nor regard any god, for he shall magnify himself above all. But in his estate he shall honor the god of forces. This is Rome. Power! Army! We honor the god of power. We honor military might. We worship at the shrine of force. It's a pretty good description of Rome. And a god whom his fathers knew not, he shall honor with gold and silver, and with precious stones and pleasant things. Then thus shall he do in the most strongholds with a strange god, whom he shall acknowledge and increase with glory, and he shall cause them to rule over many and shall divide the land for gain. The strange god here is a reference to probably the fact that the Caesars did give the chief honor to Jupiter. It's not a god that their fathers worshipped. And so this is the ways of the Caesars in terms of their blasphemy, in terms of their religion. They were men who worshipped themselves and worshipped force. Verse 40 talks about the wars they had against the Syrians and the Egyptians. And at that time, at the time of the end, shall the king of the south push at him. And the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind with chariots and with horsemen and with many ships. And he shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over. That is, this king will defeat the king of the north and the king of the south. There's another reason I don't think Hal could be Antiochus, because this is the king that's fighting these Ptolemies and the Seleucids. Verse 41 speaks then about their possession of Palestine. He shall enter into the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown. But these shall escape out of his hand, even Edom, Moab, and the chief of the children of Ammon. Which again is historically true. The Romans did not bother themselves with these people who lived at the fringes of the area of Palestine, in the rocks and caves and holes of the ground there bordering the great desert. And then their further conquests are stated here. He shall stretch forth his hand also upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. They conquered Egypt, but he shall have power over the treasures of gold and silver and over all the precious things of Egypt. And the Libyans and the Ethiopians shall be at his steps. They conquered even up unto that point. But tidings out of the east and out of the north shall trouble him. This is a reference to the great difficulty that the Romans have with the Parthians, who came at them from the northeast, basically. And they had a lot of trouble putting down the Parthians. But they eventually succeeded in stopping them, though they never really did conquer them. And then he will go forth a great fury utterly to make away many. And then it says, he shall plant his tabernacles of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain. Yet shall he come to his end, and none shall help him. Again, exactly describing Rome. The seas here, I believe, being the Caspian Sea, and the other sea being the Mediterranean Sea. The Caspian Sea up here to the northeast, Mediterranean to the southwest, and in between is the Holy Land of Israel, and that Rome will plant their kingdom between the seas of the Caspian and the Mediterranean. Of course, they also went west in their conquest, but this is a reference to how Judea will be right in the middle of that area, and they will be governed by this king, whom they will be able to identify as it goes through. This is Rome, though it is not mentioned by name. Okay, a lot in that chapter. But my desire is to particularly leave us with the challenge concerning these things. The life of the godly is a life of conflict and turmoil. And it's not only just what we ourselves bring about by our sins, but we live in a world of conflict, in a world of turmoil. These things should not trouble us nor shake us. Our God is still on the throne. All of these events are coming to pass according to His purpose, and all ultimately serve His kingdom and His advance. But furthermore, Daniel, in a very sobering note, reminds us here in this chapter of the reality of persecution and what it costs, what it means, when it happens, its effect upon us, and the necessity, the great necessity that lays upon us even now, that we build ourselves up in our most holy faith, that we know the Holy Covenant, and that we are committed to keeping it. Because when that time comes, there will be no opportunity for neutrality. You either will stand strong and do exploits and teach God's truth, or you will turn in apostasy and deny your Lord and His covenant. Father, bless our study this day. And now as we go to our interaction, we pray that if it please Thee, we will continue to think of these things. In Jesus' name, amen. All right. Our public interaction for the time for our men, the covenanting men, to ask questions and add to the teaching here today. And I look forward to that. It's an important time for us.
Yes, I have a couple comments and questions. Very interesting passage, certainly. One of the additional points under persecution that I think should be made is that there are times under persecution for armed resistance. As we look here at the history of the Maccabeans, what do the people do that know their God?
Mm-hmm.
They do exploits.
Mm.
Now, many times we've spiritualized that as doing exploits in spiritual ways of continuing to proclaim the gospel, and the church still is being built and so forth. However, I think the point drawn from this case here is that there was a time for legitimate and proper armed resistance. And
very
I think
good.
That's where the whole discussion of interposition that we've been having in the case of Judge Moore certainly has application in a time of persecution.
Excellent.
I think we do well to teach that, especially living in the particular county that we do.
Can I comment on before you move on? I think I would put that under the response to persecution, under that heading that I had there. Apostasy or faithfulness. But one of the means, and I really appreciate bringing this out, is that one of the means of faithfulness can include armed resistance. In fact, historically, these exploits that we know that the godly carried out involved in one aspect of the resistance was armed resistance, where they threw off this. And if you picture a situation 100 years from now, and this country is overrun by the Muslim hordes, and they are murdering us, they are raping our wives and daughters, and they're, you know, this type of thing, that the people of God may need to come together and rise up in an armed resistance against that type of a situation. And that is a godly response. And the Maccabees and this passage, which seems to... Calvin, by the way, goes into the sense that this is approving of the Maccabees, but not necessarily everything they did in every way they did it. But that God's approval is shown here in this passage about their armed resistance against this tyranny. And therefore, there is that place.
Yeah. Well, that's right. The second one here, and perhaps you dealt with this in chapter 8. I believe I was gone over the one particular sermon that you gave. But I have a question here on the abomination that maketh desolate in verse 31. I don't know if you dealt with that. But my question is this. Here in chapter 11, it speaks out of the pollution of the sanctuary of strength and the taking away of the daily sacrifice, and they shall place the abomination that maketh desolate.
Right.
You referred that to the erection of the altar to Jupiter. I believe there was also a pig that was slaughtered then upon the
altar
that's true.
Yeah,
as
And they slaughtered a pig there, yeah.
Right, mm-hmm. Which of course was a direct abomination.
Right.
Then, however, if we go into chapter 12, which you'll probably be dealing with next Lord's Day. In verse 11, it says there, the time that the daily sacrifice shall be taken away and the abomination that maketh desolate set up, there shall be 1,290 days. So
right.
Here's there, and perhaps that's a different abomination that maketh desolate. And I'm wondering if that isn't so, because in Matthew 24, when Jesus speaks about the destruction of the temple, he also refers to an abomination that maketh desolate, spoken of by the prophet Daniel, that is yet in the future.
Right.
And I was just wondering if you can comment on that at all, or perhaps then maybe deal with it.
Of course, I'm not going to comment on the chapter 12 one yet. But I will comment in general, because we saw this also in chapter 9 on the 70 weeks prophecy, verse 27. He shall confirm the covenant with many for a week. In the midst of the week he shall cause the sacrifice and oblation to cease. For the overspreading of abomination he shall make it desolate. So there is an abomination of desolation and so forth that's stated here also in chapter 9. I think that what we're encountering here is that similar actions that took place, as in the Matthew 24 statement of what the Romans did and what Antiochus did, they were similar acts of desecration. Similar, not identical. And that both of them were things that were abominations that desolated the holy ground of the temple and so forth. So what I'm saying here is, I don't think we have to refer to them as being the same events.
Okay.
Any apostasy can take a lot of different forms in different ages, and you can say that was apostasy. So I'm saying that you can say that was an abomination that desolated, that was an abomination that desolated there. And so that's how I think we're talking about here. Similar acts, but different ones. I don't think this one in chapter 12 is the same one as this one.
Well, and that's was my take on it too, because of the separation of days.
Yeah.
What you're in essence saying then is there are several different abominations that made desolate.
Right.
And I think I would concur with that. It would seem to make the most sense that way.
Yeah, even though it wasn't called this, think of the history of the kings under Ammon, who was so wicked. They actually did put heathen temples during the area of the Judean kings when they were so apostate in the holy place.
Right.
And put altars to pagan gods. And they were abominations that desolated the holy place. And so you have this happening different times in history. It's the desolating of the holy place of God. Someone else. Michael.
Maybe I wasn't paying close enough attention, but I'm not clear on what period of time you're saying verses 40 through 45 refer to. Is that the end of the Roman Empire in the 300s and 400s? Or is that the end of the Roman Republic before Christ? Or how did you lay that out?
Okay, I did not lay it out.
Okay. So you caught me. I didn't miss it then.
Caught me. Probably slipped that one by. No. Again, I'm not exactly sure.
Okay.
It could be the time of the end of the Seleucid and the Syrian, the Syrian and the Egyptian dynasties, because it speaks of their, because they had dominion in that area of the world for centuries now, for like 250 years or so. And the time of the end of that desolation of the king of the south, the time of the end of the king of the south and the king of the north, could refer to that. It could refer again to the time of the end as we're moving along in this prophecy, to the period that brings about the end of it, when the Romans are now coming to power, which is leading directly into the era of the Messiah. I really don't know, Michael, exactly what that's referring to, but it's not talking about the end times. I mean, every time, just because it's the time of the end, it has to be referenced by something. He's not talking here about what some people call the end times, that are still yet in our future, so forth.
So, in other words, the important point is just that 36 through 45 is before the incarnation of Christ.
What's that?
36 through 45 must be placed before the incarnation of Christ, before the birth of Christ.
That's my view on it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And because I'm not going to, I do not want to be belligerent over that with anybody, because I think there's different views that have been spoken about it. They call this the rise of, this is a description of the tyranny of the Roman Church, the Pope, and so forth, and they sought to tie these things in. I think it's best, though, given the broader context of Daniel, which I've tried to develop throughout, whether I'm right or wrong, you have to decide, but the focus of Daniel is the history from captivity to Christ. And the future in Daniel is only the implications of what comes after the Messiah takes place. And it, therefore, it's not predicting about events in the future from our perspective, except in the sense that the kingdom is still not reached all men and nations, on, like Daniel 7 says, that are honoring him and worshiping and so forth. That still has to come to pass. But we're in the process of that right now.
But all the details are of that last section of chapter 11 are not clear.
I think it's of Rome, and first starts out with a description of the Caesars and their contempt for religion, really, and particularly the true religion. And that, I believe, we looked at in the little horn section of chapter 7 when he talked about very similar terminology about how the Caesars would blaspheme God and so forth. And then, though, beginning at verse 39 through the end is the politics or the conflicts of Rome in that region of the world.
Okay.
With the Seleucids, with the Ptolemies, and then with the Parthians and so forth, and how they did then take control of Palestine, verse 41. And they planted their standard of their kingdom from the seas of Caspian to Mediterranean. I think that's what it's saying.
Yeah, the reason I ask is because it bears on the placement in time of chapter 12, verses 1 through 3.
Yes, it does.
Which is so controversial.
And who Michael is.
Well,
so we're not done with that one yet. We talked about who Michael is, and the common view being an angel, but we presented that Michael, the best evidence is it's not an angel, but Christ. So, we'll talk more about that next week. Lord willing, we're going to be finishing Daniel next week. Okay, let's have our concluding song and our offering then.